singleness is more and more prevalent. The question is, why is this so? Is it because of our fear of vulnerability? Is it because of our fear of pain? Is it because of our fear of heartache? Or is it because our expectations of life are unrealistic?
You're listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. On this program, Dr. Jack Crabtree and marriage and family therapist Christine Barber continue the discussion on the important topic of singleness. It seems that singleness is more prevalent today than in the past. Why is this so? One reason may be the fear of marriage. For many, marriage presents too many challenges and therefore is avoided. But is avoiding marriage, because it is often difficult work, a good reason to stay single? Let's listen now to Jack and Christine.
This is our third program on singleness and Christianity at work in relationships. Before we started taping, Jack and I had quite a discussion about a bunch of different items that we want to discuss today. One of them sounded really boring to me, actually. It was, why is singleness more prevalent today? But I think we have some interesting things to say about it. Jack, why don't you begin?
Seems to me that there's two things that are going on in our society today. On the one hand, with the, well, the one leads into the other. I think the first thing is that there's no longer the same kind of social support, societal support for marriage that there used to be earlier in our culture and throughout most of human history. We were talking earlier about, if you look at the television shows today, the most popular television shows, something like Friends or Seinfeld or ER, you know, how many people that are, how many characters on those shows are single? Virtually all of them. And if they're not single, if they're married, they're probably having an adulterous affair. So what's presented in the media constantly is the notion that what's sort of normal and hip and cool is the life of the single person.
Which is such a contrast to what we grew up with in the 50s and 60s.
Absolutely.
On TV, we watched the Flintstones with two married couples. At least I watched the Flintstones.
You watched the Flintstones.
You didn't watch the Flintstones.
No, I did. I did.
Okay. Leave It to Beaver.
Ozzie and Harriet. Lassie.
They all had married couples, and we took it for granted that we would see married couples on the TV.
Yeah, so there was the statement that was coming through the media was that being married is normal. It's what life is all about, kind of. And that's certainly that the media is presenting a whole different message today. Now, there's a whole discussion we could have about, does the media shape our thinking, or does it reflect our thinking, or what's the relationship between what's going on in the media and the actual attitudes of the populace? And I don't pretend to be able to analyze that. But it is just interesting. I mean, there's something going on there that you have such a discrepancy in worldview between the 50s and the 90s.
So what you're saying is that where we used to have a whole society that said, get married, that's the thing to do, now we have a society that really says, in many ways, at least through our media, don't get married. It's not really a very cool thing to do. Stay single. And if you are married, perhaps you can have an affair, or don't take it very seriously.
Right, because marriage is a bummer, marriage is a drag, marriage is painful, marriage is hard work, it's just not worth it. I think that's the message so many people are hearing.
And it is true, marriage is difficult, marriage is a struggle, marriage is work, and it's worth it.
Exactly.
It's the change on that.
Right.
Why is it worth it? Because it's the classroom that God's giving us to grow up and learn.
And there's ultimately a delight there that cannot be found in any other form of relationship, in any temporary relationship.
There's a delight there, not for everybody. Actually, few people actually experience the delight of marriage.
Well, that's true, yeah. But that's not marriage's fault. That's the fault of our own sin and our own selfishness and our unwillingness to take it on.
Exactly.
That I said that the one leads to the other. I think that lack of societal support then feeds the fears of individual people. They see from their own experience parents that are divorced, or aunts and uncles that are divorced, or friends that are divorced. They see the pain of that. Then they turn their TV on and they get this message that reinforces that. And no wonder, you have people who are just scared to death of marriage. They have perhaps been involved in relationships headed toward marriage, or relationships with the opposite sex that were painful. They were disappointed. They felt betrayed. They, it was a very painful experience for them, and they put all that stuff together and they say, it's not worth it to me. I just don't want to deal with a relationship. And I think that's just increasing tremendously in our society. So people are scared to death, and they manage their fear just by staying away from it.
I think a lot of people also are very afraid because they've not only because they've seen relationships fail or been in a relationship that fails, but because for some people, they, even if they don't know consciously, but intuitively or unconsciously, they have the sense of their own inadequacy. And it's very difficult to think about being in a marriage where those inadequacies might be uncovered.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a reason for a lot of failed marriages, by the way, is that I go into a relationship deciding I'm going to protect and hide myself from being seen. And the relationship really doesn't have much of a foundation or much to go on because I'm just hiding who I am. It's very scary to be seen, to be that vulnerable, to take the risk of rejection. And that's a risk that perhaps some of the people who aren't married are afraid to take. Another fear that perhaps a lot of single people have, and the reason they may not get married, is because they've experienced loss in their own lives. Perhaps they've experienced the loss of someone that was really close to them, like a sibling or a parent, and they've experienced how painful it is to lose once you've really loved and committed yourself and been involved with somebody really closely. And so to be in a marriage and to think about being that connected to another person and to know that at least someday you're going to lose them is a really frightening thing. Loss also can come from having experienced divorce, either from your own parents or yourself. And that connectedness that you've had before and then the breaking of that is really difficult. As a counselor, lots of times I see, it's amazing to me how many times I see a person who has either had an affair with one of their spouse's best friends or somebody at work, or it's just so prevalent that there's a breaking of a marriage because of a relationship with somebody else. And very often I'll see the spouse that has been left, and it's a very, very poignant and very, very long-lasting hurt that people experience in their lives. Sometimes people come to me after 5 years or more after the incident, and they're still really, really aching from it. So that kind of a situation makes it very difficult for somebody to consider being married again, and actually quite an act of courage, especially when they've been or feel like they've been betrayed by their husband or wife because they've gone with their best friend or someone they knew well. It's a real hard thing. And I know for myself, the fear of loss is big for me. My husband turned 50 last week, and in many ways, I like age. I like what it does to us. I like the maturity that it has brought in our lives and the security and the history that we have together. But when we woke up on the day of his birthday, I cried. Not because I was sad he was 50 per se, but it really woke me up to the realization that someday he'll be 60, and someday he'll be 70, and someday he won't be alive anymore. And to lose him is so difficult for me to comprehend, to think about living this life without him after I've become so accustomed to and worked so hard at being together with him. It's a very difficult thing.
What do you tell yourself? How do you deal with such a fear?
The fear of the loss of my husband?
For example, yeah.
Jack, that's such a good question. It's difficult to answer, and I wouldn't want to answer it in a way that I would expect other people to have to follow my formula exactly.
Okay.
But what I do with it is a couple of things. One is, like that morning, I just let myself cry. I asked my husband to hug me, and I talked to him about what I was feeling. For me, that's a really big and important part of being able to deal with something, is not pretend that it doesn't exist, but allow it to exist in an appropriate way to the extent that it does. So if I find myself sobbing about it, then I find myself sobbing about it. I don't say to myself, oh, Christine, you shouldn't feel this bad. The fact is, I do. Now, I could bring that to a point that was irresponsible. I could be unable to go out for weeks and weeks because I'm sobbing about something that's unrealistic. But it seems to me that when I allow myself to really feel the depth of my own grief. It comes in a very, very big wave, like a tidal wave, and then it subsides. And I've turned around and I faced the dragon, so to speak, that I'd rather run away from. But the pain that I feel in that moment is certainly less harmful than the pain that I would experience in my life if I decided to just run away from it.
Are you saying anything to yourself in the midst of feeling that pain? Are you trying to change the way you're perceiving reality in any way?
Not at that point. I'm just allowing myself to experience the reality as I'm experiencing it then, and I go through the tidal wave. It's after that point, after I've let myself really know the grief, that I can come back and talk to myself differently. Let's take a break, and let's talk about that when we come back.
Jack and Christine will be back in just a few moments. Here's something about Jack Crabtree. Years ago, he began to seriously study the Book of Romans. So what, you say? Lots of people study the Book of Romans. Well, the more Jack studied, the more he began to see a difference between what he had always believed Christianity to be all about and what the Book of Romans was telling him. The difference bothered him, and he had to get to the bottom of it. What emerged was a fresh and insightful understanding of the gospel, an understanding that changed his life. Over the years, Jack has taught on the Book of Romans, other books of the Bible, and numerous topics. In each case, he brings his desire to get to the bottom of it. He believes that it's worth our while to seek out truth, even if it's hard work. Christine Barber is a professional marriage and family therapist. Because she works closely with people who are suffering and struggling through life's toughest problems, she has to be committed to truth. This means being committed to her clients' best interest, to their growth as wise people, and to see real change in people's lives being the work of God. For her, the answers to life's big questions are rooted in the truth of God's Word. She sees this world as the arena where God grows us up into wise people who love the things of God and look forward to His kingdom. Now, here again are Jack and Christine.
The question you asked before the break was really important, Jack. You said, in the midst of my grief, the grief of loss, do I ask myself any questions? And I said, no, at that point, when I'm feeling the intensity of my grief, I don't ask myself any really important questions other than, how do I feel about this? And I talk about how I feel, or I just, maybe I'm unable to talk and I just cry about it. To me, it's real important when I feel grief, and I certainly think this is true for everyone, is to be able to do it with somebody else. Now, as we're talking about singleness today, it occurs to me that's real hard for a single person to have somebody that they can grieve with at the level that we need to. But I certainly think each person needs to nurture that kind of relationship that they can be completely open with another person or very vulnerable with another person. It's very important for us to be with other people when we're feeling the depth of our own grief. If we don't, what it does is it increases the loneliness that we experience. Rather than feel connected to and close to another person, we feel a further sense of distance and loss. And it's when we feel something too great without another person, we can get lost in it. And our ability to reason with ourselves after the grief has passed or we've gone through the tidal wave of it, becomes more difficult. You follow that?
We have a problem with our imagination running wild and no one outside of my grief to be a kind of reality check on where my head is going. So
that's part of it. But being with another person is just a restful place for us. It's a place where we can have a little bit more stability inside our hearts. I'm with somebody, they're with me, I feel cared about. There's just a need in us to be connected in that way to another person. It makes us more grounded, makes us feel like we have feet on the ground, like we have gravity. And so having another person with us gives us a sense of ourselves, gives us a sense of connectedness, which is really important. Both those things are really important psychologically to us. The question you are asking here is, what do we do with loss? So that's really the first stage that I usually go through. And I should say I go through that first stage if I'm being responsible. Very often I'm not responsible. Sometimes when I feel fear, I don't allow myself to know it because it's a scary thing. The grief, the tidal wave is big. And so what I do instead is I get angry and beat somebody up, so to speak, with my words or with my attitude. I was telling you right before we started taping today that on a scale of 1 to 10, I was in the minus category this weekend. And I really think it had to do with that, that I had some fears that I wasn't willing to face into. And instead of feeling the appropriate sorrow and flowing down with that, I just got mad at everybody around me and was really irresponsible with that. So, and that's certainly how a lot of people are. So for me not to say that here and to act as though I am responsible with my grief or my fears all the time is simply not true. I'm not, and nobody is. I'd say a lot of things to myself after that. One is that how important it is that I understand and know who God is in my life, because without really understanding who God is in my life, the meaning of my life becomes something other than it should be. The meaning of my life, for example, becomes my husband. And if the meaning of my life is based on him, if he is what makes life for me, then I have become dependent on him for my okayness, dependent on him for my life to be able to exist in a healthy way. So what I tell myself is, what is this life about? This life is about who is God, and how does God, what place does God have in my life? Very often when I'm really hurting, my mind goes back to a time I had talked about my cancer before and being rolled up in a ball and asking myself the question, what's important here? Who is God? Did God, is my life worth anything? Because here now at age about 33, I might die. Was this all just a waste? And I go back to the answer that I had then, and it's really a cornerstone for me to think back and say, I remembered that God was important to me, and I remembered who he was. And so in the depth of grief, I go back to something that was the deepest grief for me and understand in that deepest grief what had meaning for me.
That's what I was looking for, is that it does seem to me, I as I look for ways of dealing with fears, desires, passions of various kinds in our lives, it just seems to me that ultimately it's a true perception of reality that is the final antidote to the ways in which my passions and fears and desires can take me in the wrong direction. That the final antidote is I need to see reality the way it really is in its appropriate priorities. And that's, I think, what you were just saying, is that if you can finally remember what the truth is about your life and your existence and what it's all about, then a lot of those fears that we have shrink. They turn to vapor, or at least become manageable in size, because we are reminded that, I mean, because what happens is our imagination, which is our worst enemy sometimes, our imagination can, by looking at reality in the wrong way, can make a problem in my life look like an insurmountable problem in my life. The loss of a spouse, the loss of a husband, the loss of a wife, the loss of a child, financial ruin. One of the things that Jesus said that's just so striking to me is at one point he said, don't fear those who can kill you, and after that they have no more than that they can do to you. Fear the one who, after you have died, has the authority to cast you into hell. Something like the fear of death can be huge in people's lives. And yet, Jesus is speaking right into the face of that. Somebody could kill you? Oh, is that all they can do? Big deal. He's kind of shrinking that problem or that threat, that danger that we perceive. He's shrinking it down to proper proportions. It really, in the final analysis of what our existence is all about and who we are and who God is really not very threatening. It's really not a big deal. But in order for that to happen, we have to ultimately really believe the truth. And that takes time, years, suffering, going through the kind of grief where we really have to confront, what do I believe is the appropriate perception of reality? and have that perception really deeply embedded in my soul before it becomes real in a way that can be an antidote to my desires and passions and fears.
Be an antidote that isn't just a denial system. Be an antidote that is real.
Yeah, it actually literally resolves my fears rather than covers them up and hides them. Yeah.
And I think lots of us, especially early on as Christians, have heard the words, God is most important in my life. And so we try and place that on top of our fears, and it doesn't work.
Because we don't really believe it is the problem.
Well, we might really believe it in our head.
Yeah, but that's my point, yeah.
Right. That is your point. It's like, in my heart, I haven't gotten it.
Right.
And I'm so with you. It just takes years and years and years before people can really understand and know it.
And I think it's important to say it's not my job, ultimately. It's not my job to believe it. I mean, I'm not saying to people out there who find themselves not believing it enough to really resolve their fears, I'm not saying to them, well, start believing it. Yeah, we're powerless to do that. It has to be something that God supernaturally etches on my heart. And he does that through this process that the New Testament calls sanctification. And the process of sanctification is largely through suffering. It's going to take time, but that's what God is committed to doing. And as he does that, it really becomes a bulwark against our fears.
Jack, thank you for saying that. I work with so many people who say to me they want to be able to see that.
Yeah.
They hope to be able to see that, but they just don't now. And they ask me the question, do I have to figure it out? Do I have to carry myself? Because I don't think I can. And my answer always is no, you don't have to carry yourself. Yeah. Ultimately, God will, and we just have to do one step at a time. There's a whole lot of really depressed and really discouraged people out there that we're talking to and that are listening probably here today. And I'd like to say that to them very directly, that God's going to take you through it. He's going to carry you through it. And all you need to do today is sometimes just submit to being alive and allow yourself to just take that one step. Get out of bed, go to work. If it's take care of your kids or clean the kitchen or whatever you have to do for that day, sometimes those tasks in themselves seem insurmountable. But submit to being alive and going ahead as much as you can, and God in you will carry you. For my husband's 50th birthday, as you know, Jack, I asked a number of our friends from years ago until through the present to write letters to my husband and talk to him about things they remembered about him, areas of growth they've seen in his life, areas of encouragement, things they've done, that impacts that they've had in his life, a variety of things. And we received one letter from a woman that was in a church that my husband pastored many years ago. It was that pastoring experience was an extremely difficult experience for me. I was talking to this woman who wrote the letter yesterday on the phone, telling her thank you for that letter, because up until now I had only in my head known intellectually that God had a meaning in that situation for us. I knew he did, but I really couldn't see a meaning. And in her letter, the way she described things was so impactful for me. At the time that my husband was a pastor, she lost her husband in a car accident. She was an atheist, but was willing to look at and understand Christianity through my husband's eyes, because in her words, my husband was suffering with what was going on in the church and in his life then, as much as she was with the loss of her husband. She said to me, haven't other things been more difficult for you in your life besides that experience in your ministry there? And I said, no, nothing has been more difficult than that for me. And she didn't get it. And I explained to her that the reason that was more difficult for me is because at that point in my life, I was only 25 and 26 and 27. I was too young. I hadn't gone through the depth of struggle that would give me a foundation to really understand and believe God in my life. I didn't see it. I knew it. I was the pastor's wife in the church, and I could say it. But it took me years and years and years past that to really understand and know that God is real, and that when I think of him and when I see his purpose in my life, it has meaning for me such that it diminishes even the pain of the biggest losses of my life, even facing into the future loss of my own husband. So, Jack, how we got here was you asked me the question, how do I deal with fears in my life? And we had a whole discussion about that. But where we started is with singleness. So in context, you were asking, how do singles then deal with the fears that they have in their lives?
With their fear of marriage, yeah. And it seems to me that there's two things that they need to ultimately come to perceive. One is they just need to change their expectations about life, I think. And this is not just peculiar to single people. Married people have, in our society, I think, have the same problem. But having this false expectations, it really amplifies their fear of marriage. Namely, the expectation that life is supposed to go smoothly without pain, without suffering, without disappointment, without futility. It's just not true. And I think there were past generations in our society who understood that better than we do. Something about our modern age where technology solves every problem for us really kind of makes it plausible that we could be born into this world and go to our grave. There's an irony in that. Go to our grave thinking that life will just be, a
easy
piece of
and
cake.
Smooth.
You know?
Yeah.
That's not a realistic expectation. In a very real sense, we are born to suffer and we are reborn to suffer. We are placed in Christ as his disciples to suffer. And we have to come to terms with that. So if I get married and it's disappointing and futile and full of anguish, okay, that's reality. That's no reason not to get married. That's what my life and existence is all about. So we need to change those expectations.
So somebody could be saying, Jack, are you saying that all God wants for me is to suffer? Is that what you're saying?
Well, if you put it that way, of course, it sounds, you know, it makes God sound like he's not being very productive in my life. In the one sense, yes, all he wants me to do is suffer. But that's because all he wants is for me to enter into glory one day. And the road to glory is through suffering. It just is. Why? I don't know. Why does God run the universe the way he does? I don't know. But what it has become clear to me is that that is the way God is running his universe, is that human beings are going to become prepared for the kingdom of God by learning the wisdom and the love of God and the fear of God and the knowledge of God that comes through suffering. So in that sense, yes, all he wants me to do is suffer. But it's not like he wants me to suffer because he's into suffering, you know, because he wants me to
because
to
there's
feel
no
lousy.
Productive end.
Yeah, it's because of the end that he has in view.
So I'm going to imagine a couple of questions people might ask in this regard. So you're saying that God might not want me to have any joy in my life?
Oh, no. Yeah, our existence is full of all kinds of joys and delights and good gifts that God has built into his creation for us to enjoy and to find delight in. And that's going to be a part of our existence. And we all know that. I mean, we all pursue those delights in creation. Our existence is chock full of opportunities for fun and pleasure and that sort of thing. But
and is it okay to pursue those things?
Absolutely.
Is it okay to have a great family vacation?
Sure. As long as we always have the proper perspective that nothing in this world is life itself to me. Nothing in this world is really finally and ultimately what my existence is all about. Really, I think only then am I free to enjoy the stuff of this world. If I really need to find meaning and significance out of the stuff in this world, it sort of spoils it. It wrecks it for something to give me joy because it can't bear the weight of actually defining my existence and making my existence meaningful. If I know that this world is not big enough and lasting enough and full enough to give my existence meaning, then I can take it for what it is, a delight, a joy, a good thing that I can take pleasure in.
Over the years, a lot of people have come through Mackenzie Study Center. Some have come to study biblical interpretation. Some come to focus on applying the truth of the Bible to the world we live in. And others come for the great Bible teaching. And still others come because they need a place to think about their faith. What is Mackenzie? it's a group of people who take the Bible seriously, who see the goal of this life as the pursuit of righteousness and wisdom, who see the gospel as the most profound message in all of human history. They see the need to get back to the Bible as more important than ever in this darkening world. Getting back to the Bible means trying to understand what the biblical authors intended to say when they wrote the Bible. And this can be hard work. The scriptures are often difficult to interpret and understand. Sometimes the Bible doesn't always say what we want it to say. But if we are to come to understand this world and our place in it from God's perspective, then the hard work of biblical interpretation is worth it. This is the passion motivating the staff and families of McKenzie Study Center. If you are interested in knowing more about McKenzie, we'll give you information on how to contact us at the end of the program. Then when you do, you might ask for some of our News and Views articles, such as Forgiveness, the Parable of the Unforgiving Servant by Ron Julian. In this article, Ron takes a close look at Christ's statement that if we don't forgive, we will not be forgiven. Ron's conclusion is that Christ meant exactly what he said. God's people know that they are sinners, and only the mercy of God stands between them and their deserved destruction. It is this humility, without which no one can come to the cross of Christ, which results in forgiving others. Ron argues that Jesus makes this point most forcefully in the parable of the unforgiving servant. Or you might want to read Nancy Scott's article, Making Contact with Postmodernism, in which she takes a close look at the popular movie, Contact. Nancy shows us how this film clearly reflects our culture's changing views on knowing truth. For a Christian, this is important. Christians have always maintained that truth exists and can be known with ample certainty. Nancy shows that the story of Contact is a postmodern tale about the relativity and uncertainty of truth, that all truth is only based on one's personal, subjective experience. She states, contemporary films are one of the most powerful languages articulating truth in our culture today. And Contact provides an excellent example of how effectively authors can present their worldview. Ready or not, our culture has embraced the postmodern version of reality that Contact illustrates. Again, at the end of the program, we'll give you information on how you can find out more about McKenzie Study Center.
We have been saying that as a single person, we need to change our expectations about life. Our expectation that life should be good and happy and wonderful and smooth and full of joy. But really our expectation as a single person, or really as any person, needs to be more realistic. And the realistic side is much more difficult. Life is not that smooth. Life is not a setup so that everything will go really well. And I think it's a really good point you said. In our technological society, we have this sense that things should go well. And it seems to me also, Jack, that there's a lot of parents, myself, I'm sad to say included, that try to make children feel like things will be okay. We try to take pain out of their lives. And I imagine that, I think about, you know, the Oregon Trail, here we live in Oregon, and all those stories that I hear about those families coming across the trail. Those parents weren't looking toward making their children just feel good. They were helping their children face into the reality of life. And that's a real difficult thing to do as a parent, to allow my child to go through a tremendous amount of pain. But anyway, we need, as a single person and as any person, to make our expectations in line with reality. Reality is that there will be suffering in our lives, and there will be a lot of suffering. That's the tool that God uses to mature us, to grow us up, to bring us into the kind of understanding that he wants us to have about life, about ourselves, about him.
And what single people need to understand is that marriage is one of the classrooms for that experience and for that growth.
Marriage is one of the classrooms, not the only classroom.
No.
Maybe the classroom that God is bringing a single person through is their singleness.
Yeah, the point I'm making, though, is in confronting their fears, oftentimes a single person may not want to go into that relationship because their expectation is it was supposed to be a protection from all pain and suffering, and I look at other people who are married and it doesn't seem to be any protection at all. Why would I want to go in there? And my answer to why would you want to go in there is because it's another classroom, and it's an important classroom, and if there's no other reason not to go in there, go ahead. That's life. That's reality. That's our relationship with God, is to be in context where God will teach us wisdom.
Face into what's very difficult.
Yeah.
I often talk to single people who are thinking about getting married, and they ask me about their fiancé, and bring the fiancé in, and we all talk together, and they often say, see, we have all these problems, and things are really difficult, and gosh, we don't communicate well here. We have this problem with this difference here or there. And don't you think that's really going to be a problem in our lives? And I say, yeah, absolutely. I think it's going to be a really big problem. Go for it. Mm-hmm. What I ask people who are single and looking toward marriage to think about when they're choosing a spouse is this person teachable? I don't think there's any value, certainly there is no value, in marrying somebody just to get my head beat up against the wall. Just to get, I don't mean that necessarily, literally, but why get married to someone who has no interest in pursuing a relationship, has no interest in pursuing what's good, who has no interest in trying to do what's right? I'm just going to be in an incredibly desolate situation. However, it makes all the sense in the world to me to marry a person who is obviously hurting, who is obviously a sinner, and who is obviously very much willing to pursue what's good and right. That isn't a reason to shrink away from marriage, because it doesn't matter who we marry. Every marriage is going to have its own problems. What these people who are young and asking me these questions have ahead of other people who don't think there's problems is they're looking at reality. They're already knowing that things aren't going to be easy. And they're right. It's so hard to get married, like I was, and then find out things get hard.
Yeah.
It's like, man, I married the wrong person. Or, gee, how come they messed up so badly? Or, wow, I didn't know I was this way. But how great to enter a marriage knowing that I'm a sinner and you're a sinner and this is the way our sin looks, and let's go and try and face into it.
Yeah, that's good. The way other people relate to us, you mentioned parents to children and so on. I think that is important, that we allow one another to go through suffering as well, that parents allow their children to go through suffering, that we allow our friends to go through suffering, that we don't be the devil's advocate trying to... I'm reminded of Peter going to Jesus and saying... After Jesus was basically predicting his suffering and death on the crucifixion, and Peter saying, "Oh no, you don't want to do that." Peter playing the role of someone trying to protect him from that, and Jesus' response is, "Get behind me, Satan." That if there's suffering there that one needs to go through, then one needs to go through it. And as a friend or as a parent or someone who loves you, the right thing for me to do at times is to let you go. To let you do that. I shouldn't protect you from that. There's a lot of relationships where that pops up and becomes significant. We not only need to let ourselves go through suffering, but we need to let others go through suffering.
How do we stop other people from going through suffering? Can you give me an example of that?
Well, let's take this couple that are contemplating marriage that you're talking about. As a counselor, you could have said to them, that looks like a problem to me. Maybe you better think about this longer. Maybe you better not get married. Or even more likely, as a parent of one of them, try to counsel them, advise them, manipulate them, steer them into avoiding the marriage. No, don't go into that marriage. I just see heartache ahead for you. Well, yeah, you see heartache ahead for them. So I think the truth is that a parent needs... As much as it goes against all of our parental instincts, I think, at least it goes against my parental instincts.
Goes against mine.
We need to have the wisdom to recognize, as much as my job all of my life has been to protect my child from suffering, I know better than that. I know that they have one who is more responsible for them than even I, God, who wants them to go through heartache and suffering in order to grow. I need to let that happen. And there, there comes a point where I need to lay my parenting role aside and let God be God in their life.
Jack, isn't that what parenting is all about? It's not protecting my children from suffering, but all along recognizing that God is really parenting them.
Yes, it should be. Yeah.
And not just when they get married. And that's God's role in our lives as single people also, is that He is allowing us to suffer along the way. And He's not taking suffering away so that we'll feel better. He's putting suffering into our lives so that we grow up.
Yeah.
One time, Jack, I heard you teach this in church. And a young woman, a single woman, young woman, as a matter of fact, rose her hand and said, "So I don't have very much suffering in my life. Should I go look for suffering?"
And I said...
You don't remember what you said.
Well, I said, let me guess. I said, "No, you shouldn't go looking for it. God is quite capable. He's very creative. He's quite capable of bringing an adequate amount of suffering in your life without your help."
That's exactly what you said.
Okay.
And that's so true. Certainly if we are not suffering at this point in time, that's another way in which we don't have to take care of ourselves.
Right.
God will take care of bringing the suffering into our lives. However, that statement, I'm realizing as I'm saying it, can be misunderstood, because if, say, that single person who asked the question is also thinking about not getting married because of their fear of suffering, then at that point they have a choice that God's put in front of them, and they probably need to make a choice that does not include them running away from the instruction that they can get through the marriage.
Yeah, but you made a distinction earlier that's an important one, and that is, it's one thing to face into the prospects of a marriage where the other person is not teachable, they are not wise, they have no interest in becoming wise. Should I do that and gain myself the suffering that's going to come from that because it's going to be good for me? My answer would be no. You'd be a fool to do that. Why would you want to become one with someone who has no intention of becoming one with you? Why would you want to become one with someone who has no intention of following God and of obeying God? I mean, that's just foolish. That's different from making a decision to go ahead knowing that life is going to be hard, but going ahead and making a wise and responsible decision to marry someone who really has a heart for God, who wants to get to know Him, who wants to be committed to me, and who wants to learn and grow together with me. That's a wise decision. That's a responsible decision. Granted, it won't always be easy, but that's part of what we buy with the whole bargain of marriage. That's okay. You know, what I'm getting at is, I don't go out and create suffering for myself just for the sake of creating suffering for myself. I go out and I make wise and responsible decisions in life, sometimes knowing that what I'm choosing is going to involve some hardship. But that's different than creating hardship for hardship's sake.
Jack, earlier asked a question that was really important. You ask, how should singles confront their fears? My answer was, I need to fully grieve what I'm afraid of. I need to face into the sorrow of perhaps the loss that I've experienced before or I fear experiencing. And then I need to be able to understand and look at the truth. I can't, though, do either of those things if I don't really understand the issue. And that's something we really need to go back to and not take for granted. Many people are very confused about why they're depressed. Many single people are very confused about why they can't seem to bring themselves to getting married. Many people don't understand what's going on in them to enough so that they can grieve straight on the loss that they're afraid of. That makes sense to you?
Not yet.
Okay. Well, let me give you an example then. So probably it doesn't make sense to people yet. I could have woken up on my husband's 50th birthday, the example I used before, and just felt really angry. I could have gone through the day just feeling very, very angry, not having a clue why I was angry. I could have noticed that my son didn't put away the dishes as I told him to, or the dog's dirty paw marks were all over the floor, or that somebody didn't call me back that I had expected to call me back, and I could have just gotten angry about all those things throughout the day. That is more typically how we live. We live not understanding the issue that is before us, but looking at things that look like the issue that are not. So I could just then say, okay, it's no big deal that these things are happening. God is bigger than that. And talk myself into understanding the place of God in my life, and that those things aren't so important, like the dirty paw marks on the floor. But what I've done is I've really missed what the issue is altogether. We need to slow down enough to understand what the issue is that day, to say, you know, the problem isn't really something outside of myself. There's something, it isn't the paw marks, it isn't the dishes, it isn't the person that called me, but I need to look inside myself and say, what is the issue inside me today? When I find myself blaming other people, other circumstances, I always need to point the finger back to myself and say, what's really going on here? On that day, what I probably needed to look at was, I'm afraid. I fear the loss of my husband. I'm sad about that. I can't grieve appropriately, and I can't understand and acknowledge God in my life to the depth that I need that, unless I really understand the issue that's going on in my life. And I think we need as a lifestyle, when we blame other people, when we look outside at other circumstances. For a single person, when I look and say, you know, I'd be okay if I weren't married, if I were just married. What they need to do is say, wait a minute, what does that say to me about me?
So the real issue is not the issue that I'm afraid of the loneliness of marriage or the isolation of marriage, or I'm afraid that I'm missing out by not being married. You're saying there's a deeper issue yet?
No, I think that is the issue.
Oh, okay.
That's exactly it. As a single person, I might say, I'm not married because I could spend a lot of time thinking I'm not married because I'm too short. I'm not married because I'm this or that situation, or my best friend took my boyfriend or something like that. And that becomes my focus, rather than focusing in on the fact that I feel very lonely and that's a very difficult place for me to be in life. That's what I need to grieve. That's what I need to understand who God is in my life about.
And as is true generally, we know God better at the same time that we understand ourselves better. And it's by understanding what really the problems, the questions, the challenges of my life are, face them head on, admit that they are what they are, rather than trying to cloak them in some other kind of explanation. By real clear self-understanding, then I'm in a position to ask how God relates to that and, in the end, get to know God better.
Oh, and that is the end. That is the purpose. It isn't just so that I feel better, though that is a much healthier way to live. Psychologically, I'll be a great deal healthier. Well, that makes sense that God set up the world that way, that I'm healthier psychologically as I also come to see God through that process in a deeper and deeper way in my life.
Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber will be back in a moment. Here's a question. What does it mean to take the Bible seriously? Does it mean that you carry your Bible with you everywhere you go? Well, maybe it does mean that. Does it mean that you read it every day? And that could be. Does it mean that you believe what it teaches is true? Certainly. But how do you know what the Bible really teaches? The staff of the McKenzie Study Center believes that discovering what the biblical authors meant when they wrote the Bible is central to taking the Bible seriously. At the heart of McKenzie is a desire to let the text speak for itself, to understand the Bible the way its authors intended. They believe the truth contained in the Bible offers a radical message for our world. They also believe that studying the Bible is a lost art. However, at McKenzie, studying the Bible is not just an intellectual exercise. It's about learning to see this world and to see ourselves the way God does. It's about coming to terms with our sin and God's wonderful mercy. It's about truly having hope in this fallen world. If you are interested in the teaching of McKenzie Study Center, we would be delighted to send you our tape catalog or the free monthly newsletter called News and Views. At the end of the program, we'll tell you how you can get in touch with us. Right now, let's get back to Jack and Christine.
Well, as it turns out, what we talked about in this session was the fear of marriage and the fact that the fear of marriage has led to a society and a culture that we live in today where there's a lot of what people call gamophobia, the fear of marriage itself. And there's a lot of, there's a big, huge single culture, something that really is unusual in human history, that there would be such a large percentage of the population that are living lives as single people. And so what we concentrated on was this fear itself. What's the root of this fear and how do we resolve this fear? At the root of the fear, I think, is a set of false expectations to start with. Expectations that life should go well and that it should not involve suffering if all goes well. In our Christian culture, we have a tendency to think that when we come to Jesus, the whole purpose of Jesus coming into my life is to save me from the pain of human existence. That's not true. In the future, we'll have a lot more to say about that, but that's just not true. If anything, we come to be disciples of Jesus in order that we might suffer, in a very real sense. And so we need to have appropriate expectations that entering into marriage, it's okay if that involves disappointment and loneliness and emptiness and heartache and grief. That's not a reason not to get married, because that's reality, that's life as a disciple of Jesus. And I think a part of the fear comes from not really having a clear understanding of what marriage is. Having just a whole collection of myths that I believe about marriage, and not having any realistic picture of what married life is supposed to be, partly because I don't have any models for a really healthy, deep marriage relationship.
A lot of what we talked about today was very, very interesting and very close to my heart. We talked about how do we deal with suffering, and of course, as a counselor, a lot of my job is helping people deal with their suffering and dealing with it in a straight-on way, rather than as a single person, for example, pretending like or denying that I don't want to get married, or changing my fear of being married into something else and distracting myself. I need to look at the reality of the situation. If I am afraid of getting married, I need to look at that fear directly. I need to look at it, see it for what it is. I need to grieve it. And I need to be able to eventually understand who God is in context of the suffering in my situation. One of the points that we made is that God will bring suffering into our lives. We don't have to bring it into our lives ourselves, but He'll bring it in to our lives. And one thing we didn't say is God brings it into our lives because He is a merciful God. He's loving us through helping us understand the biggerness of life, the what's really truly important, what truly is reality, and the way that He's designed to teach us that is through suffering. And why has He done that? Because He is a loving and merciful God who knows that far greater things can be done to us than the fears that we have today, far greater things than even our own death.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541 425-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.